Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, Houthi rebels vow revenge for U.S. strikes in Yemen in response to repeated attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea.
We examine the critical white evangelical vote ahead of the first official contest in the GOP race for the White House.
And Taiwan prepares to choose its next leader in an election that could have major implications for its alliance with the U.S. and its tense relationship with China.
The PRC is really always worried about somehow losing Taiwan. And the thing that they worry about the most, honestly, is that the U.S. will encourage Taiwan.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Houthi militants in Yemen fired a missile at a ship today and promised further retaliation after last night's U.S. and British airstrikes against Houthi targets.
U.S. officials say the airstrikes are a bid to stop the Houthi disruption of shipping through the Red Sea and not intended to widen the war in Gaza. As Nick Schifrin reports, the U.S. warned it will strike again if the Houthi campaign continues.
For as far as the eye could see, pro-Houthi demonstrators today filled the streets of the capital Sana'a, waving weapons, demanding death to their enemies, a promise repeated by Houthi leader Muhammad Ali al-Houthi.
Did you not hear yesterday, Yemeni people, the airstrikes? Are they not the same raids we have seen? They did not bring anything new, but we are the ones who will bring something new.
Last night, from jets, ships, and a submarine, the U.S. says a first round of strikes targeted 16 locations, and then 30 to 60 minutes later, an additional 12 locations with more than 150 munitions. A Western official told PBS NewsHour that was on the higher end of military options. The U.S. military says it hit more than 60 individual targets in mostly unpopulated areas, targeting air defense, drones, and missiles that the Houthis have used in recent attacks, including the Tuesday attack that precipitated the military strikes, more than two dozen Houthi drones and missiles aimed at U.S. warships.
If they continue to act and behave as they do, we'll respond.
Since November, Houthis have seized and targeted 27 commercial ships in the Red Sea. 30% of global container traffic and more than a million barrels of crude oil every day sail through the Suez Canal via the Red Sea. Now, many of those ships are rerouting around Africa, driving up consumer prices and causing supply chain delays. This morning, crude oil futures jumped 4% to more than $80 a barrel. The international reaction to the military strike was mixed. Russia called an emergency Security Council meeting and called the strikes irresponsible. Oman denounced the strikes, warning they could escalate conflict in the region. Saudi Arabia said in a statement it was following the events with great concern and called for self-restraint. For nearly 10 years, Houthi rebels backed by Iran have been fighting a Saudi-led coalition. Houthis seized the capital Sana'a in 2014 from the country's internationally recognized government. The subsequent brutal civil war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, but for the last 20 months, there's been a shaky ceasefire. Houthis and the Saudi-backed Yemeni government now agree on a roadmap to peace, and some regional and U.S. officials worry that military strikes could reverse political progress. But that could depend on what happens next and the extent of the expected Houthi military response. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
In the day's other headlines, Israel rejected allegations that it's committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Instead, it told the World Court at The Hague that its operation is a legitimate defense after Hamas attacked Israel in October. The Israelis responded today to the genocide claim made by South Africa in one of the biggest cases ever brought before an international court.
The attempt to weaponize the term genocide against Israel in the present context does more than tell the court a grossly distorted story. And it does more than empty the word of its unique force and special meaning. It subverts the object and purpose of the convention itself.
Meanwhile, in southern Gaza, fiery explosions rocked the city of Khan Yunis as the Israeli bombardment continued. Hamas officials said nearly 24,000 people have died, with 60,000 more injured since the war began. A new winter storm is sweeping across the northern U.S. tonight with heavy snow, high winds, and brutal cold. Dangerous driving conditions across Iowa today prompted warnings to stay home. Republicans canceled a number of campaign events ahead of Monday's presidential caucuses. The storm also grounded hundreds of flights at Chicago's O'Hare and Midway airports and 7,500 nationwide. Arctic air and bitter cold are expected to spread into the deep south this weekend. Federal prosecutors in Buffalo will seek the death penalty against a gunman who killed 10 black victims in 2022. The attack took place at a supermarket. A white supremacist, Peyton Gendron, pleaded guilty to state murder charges and is serving life without parole. Today, the Justice Department announced it wants Gendron executed if he's convicted of federal hate crimes. The government of Ukraine got a boost from Britain today, a promise of $3.2 billion in military aid over the next fiscal year. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak met with President Volodymyr Zelensky and signed a 10-year security deal. Zelensky celebrated the agreement and voiced hope about more American aid.
Today is the day the history of Europe has changed. Ukraine and the United Kingdom signed a new and unprecedented security agreement. Regarding Washington's help, I'm viewing this with more positivity than in December.
A package of $60 billion in U.S. assistance is being held up in Congress. Republicans are demanding major changes in U.S. border policy before they'll greenlight aid for Ukraine. China has announced a ceasefire in northeastern Myanmar. Beijing mediated the agreement between Myanmar's military and guerrillas that have seized towns and military posts along the country's border with China. A previous agreement failed to hold. The Biden administration is taking Texas to the Supreme Court in a new standoff over migrants. This week, the state fenced off a public park in Eagle Pass to stop illegal crossings, and the Texas National Guard barred the federal Border Patrol from the site. Today, the Justice Department asked the High Court to restore federal access to the park. And on Wall Street, stocks had a mixed finish to the week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 118 points to close below 37,593. The Nasdaq rose 2 points and the S&P 500 added 3. But for the week, the Nasdaq was up 3%, the S&P rose nearly 2%, and the Dow added a fraction. Still to come, on the NewsHour, a representative from the United Nations Relief Agency details the dire situation in Gaza. A new variant of COVID-19 poses an increased risk of widespread infection. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The U.S. strikes against the Houthis in Yemen mark a significant escalation of tensions in the Middle East. The world is now waiting to see whether the strikes will accomplish their goal to stop the Houthis from targeting ships in the Red Sea or raise the risk of an even wider conflict. Nadwa Al-Dasari was born and raised in Yemen and is a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Thank you for being with us. And how will the U.S.-led strikes against Houthi targets in Yemen, how will that affect the militant group's strategy moving forward, in your view?
Well, I mean, the Houthis have survived 8 years of intense airstrikes by the Saudis and the Emiratis, and they survived that and even emerged stronger than before. So airstrikes might neutralize the Houthi threat on the Red Sea shipping, but that would be temporarily.
What impact will these airstrikes have on the Houthis standing in Yemen? Do they welcome these airstrikes?
Yemenis are concerned about these airstrikes because they lived the horrors of airstrikes for 8 years, and these airstrikes caused a lot of civilian casualties, a lot of destruction, but also they made the Houthis stronger. So Yemenis at large don't want to go through, you know, another episode of airstrikes that only benefit the Houthis at the expense of Yemenis. Now, Houthis are still extremely unpopular, but the Houthis are using the Gaza war and, you know, the war with Israel and America, which is their narrative that they're at war with Israel and America. They're using that to oppress the population and silence critics. They're using that to force families to send their children to indoctrination camps, to recruit fighters, to recruit children at a mass scale. And so these airstrikes could be very good for the Houthis. The Houthis want war. They want confrontation for the U.S. They want confrontation with Israel because, and that's why they continued to, you know, to attack the ships in the Red Sea. That's how they build, you know, they make an excuse to oppress the population. So this will be good for the Houthis if it's only airstrikes.
Well, in order for the U.S. goal of deterrence to be effective on a more permanent basis, what kind of approach would be required?
Well, the U.S., the Houthis have proven to be a strategic threat to security, regional security, and international shipping. And so only a strategic approach will mitigate the Houthi threat. Now, airstrikes by the U.S. and the U.K. Are not going to address that. The U.S. and the international community need to support Yemeni government forces to weaken the Houthis militarily and rebuild Yemen.
The Houthis, as you well know, are also backed by Iran, which has supplied militias across the Middle East as a way of stepping up its own influence. How independent are the Houthis from Iran? Are they acting on their own, or are they following Iran's instructions right now?
It's both. So the Houthis are not Iran puppets. They don't carry Iran orders. Having said that, the Houthis are very strong allies with Iran, and they both have long-term goal in the region, which is Iran's expansionist agenda. And that include weakening Saudi Arabia, taking Mecca, and eventually liberating Jerusalem, in their own words, and destroying Israel. More importantly, also pushing the U.S. and the West out of the region. The Houthis also are capable of acting on their own. Iran has empowered the Houthis, it strengthened them. And I'm not even sure if Iran decided that the Houthis need to de-escalate today, that the Houthis would do that.
The White House says the strikes last night were not intended to ignite a wider regional war. You can argue that with the U.S.-led attacks against Houthi targets in Yemen, that the Israel-Hamas war has already escalated into a regional conflict. The question is whether or not it can be contained. How do you view it?
Things could spiral out of control. The risk is high. Having said that, I think it's important for the U.S. and the West to address the Houthi problem, and that's not going to happen with airstrikes. And also, it's not going to happen with putting boots on the ground. A more sustainable solution would be to work with the Yemeni government and strengthen Yemeni forces so that they can weaken the Houthis. Now, Iran and other proxies might still exist, but the Houthis have proven to be the most strategic threat to everyone, basically, in the region.
Nadwa Al-Dasari is a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Today marks 97 days of the war against Hamas in Gaza, and the humanitarian toll on its population has been devastating. According to the United Nations, 90% of Gazans are displaced. More than one in four are starving. There's not a single hospital there that's fully functional, and communications are severely limited. Earlier today, Ali Rogan was able to speak with a representative from the UN's relief agency through a shaky internet connection for an update about what's happening on the ground.
Scott Anderson with the UN Relief Works Agency in Gaza. Thank you so much for joining us. The World Food Program recently tweeted that everyone in Gaza is hungry. Can you just give us a sense of just how dire the food scarcity situation is right now?
I'm joining you from the Rafah Governorate in southern Gaza, where there are approximately 1.4 million internally displaced people here. The only food that most people have is what comes in through the crossing, either Kerem Shalom or Rafah. And it's simply not enough to accommodate the basic needs of this many people. And I've seen a convoy where people are chasing the convoy down the street because they're just desperate to get any food that they can. We did have a convoy that managed to go north a few days ago with trucks of flour. And as they were carrying their flour away, you could see how happy they were. But the situation really is quite desperate. Children begging for food because they don't have any. It's just a very difficult situation for them. And I can't imagine how their parents feel not being able to provide for them. So I think that, you know, overall, we need to do more as a humanitarian community. We need to get more food in.
And what responsibilities specifically do the various stakeholders in this conflict have, including Israel, Hamas, and other regional players?
First, we would ask that all the parties to the conflict respect the sanctity of the United Nations and that they do everything they can to protect the civilian, innocent civilian population that's here in Gaza. And we've had great difficulty accessing northern Gaza north of the Wadi. There's a checkpoint that we're required to traverse to take aid to the north, where we think there are 300,000 people. Since January 1st, only 8 of the 24 missions we have requested have been approved to go north. They're very hungry, they're very cold, they're very much in need, and we would very much like to get our convoys to the north to help deliver aid to those people.
The United Nations has called Gaza a graveyard for children. Can you talk about the situation specifically for children right now?
And children, obviously, they bear the brunt of this. They're much younger and they're less resilient. Their bodies are just smaller. I mean, in addition to the lack of food, the trauma that everybody has suffered, one in every 100 Gazans has been killed at this point during the conflict. They need psychosocial support and they need some normalcy. I feel that we're in danger of losing a generation educationally between COVID and the negative impact that had, and now we're losing a whole school year, most likely during this conflict. The impact is quite negative to children everywhere in Gaza.
As the Israeli military operation continues, what does that mean for your operations as more and more people are crowding into a smaller and smaller area?
There's not sufficient water for hygiene, and certainly for people to clean themselves, nor is there sufficient water for everyone to drink. People are living in quite close proximity, so we're worried about waterborne disease and any kind of disease that would spread quickly. Women have borne the brunt of hygiene here. There's not enough feminine hygiene kits. Women don't eat or drink. They've told me on visits to shelters because they don't want to have to wait in line to go to the bathroom. We're certainly not able to import at scale any of the monthly hygiene needs that women have, and it's something we're working very hard to correct.
You've lost colleagues in this. 146 UNRWA workers have been killed since this conflict began. Can you just describe the toll that this war is having on your colleagues, humanitarian workers, and the work that you do?
And we say that nowhere is safe in Gaza, which I think is very true. Even the house where I live in has received fire from Israeli forces. You can't talk to any of our staff or any of their families that haven't been impacted by the loss of a loved one or the severe injury of a loved one. Despite the loss, they get up every day, they come into work, and they're trying to help their fellow Gazans. Now, we have one staff member that works out our cross-border operation. Both his brothers lost everyone in their family except one son. And despite that horrific event, he was there at the crossing the next day trying to make sure aid was flowing in to help take care of people. So I think that the resilience and the bravery and courage they show is incredible, but it also has to be very heavy on their heart that they don't know sometimes when they leave if their family will be there when they go home.
Israel has long been critical of UNRWA. It accuses UNRWA of having an anti-Israel stance and of not being hard enough on Hamas. How do you respond to those criticisms?
I think we do a lot of work to maintain our neutrality, which is one of the core humanitarian principles. And I certainly am not anti-Israel in any way, shape, or form. We're here to do a job, to do it with, as I said, with neutrality, which is one of our core principles. Sometimes that means we say things that people don't like to hear. What we are is pro-humanity, and we want to do everything we can to keep as many people as safe as possible and make sure we're meeting their basic needs every day.
Scott Anderson, the Deputy Director of UNRWA in Gaza, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ali.
The Iowa caucuses are now just 3 days away, which means the candidates are making their final pitches to voters, including one coveted group, white evangelicals. Lisa Desjardins is in Des Moines and sat down with perhaps Iowa's most recognizable and influential evangelical leader.
Bob Vanderplatz is often called a kingmaker in Iowa politics. Since 2010, he's directed the conservative Christian group, The Family Leader, which advocates for what they see as biblical values in government, opposing abortion, and gay marriage. Vanderplatz has endorsed the eventual winner in every Iowa Republican caucus since 2008. In November, he announced his support for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. I began by asking him why he made that decision and about polls that show most Iowa evangelicals support former President Donald Trump.
Well, first of all, why DeSantis? He caught my attention right away when he won re-election in 2022. He took a toss-up state like Florida and turned it deep red, won by 20 points. And he did that after leading on things that are very important to us. Well, it's the sanctity of human life, parental rights, taking on the woke agenda in schools, in big corporations, keeping Florida open during COVID, challenging all the mandates during COVID. You mentioned about the evangelical support. My pulse just doesn't line up with the polls. We have a very large base here, and that means every other person I talk to would have to tell me, I'm voting Trump. They're not saying that. They're appreciative of what he did, but they believe we need to turn the page to the next generation leader. They believe we need to find somebody who can win and lead. And I think they're skeptical that he's just not the same guy that he was in 2016.
How well does Governor DeSantis or Nikki Haley have to do in order to really make this a race, have a chance at beating Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's all an expectations game right now. And everybody's dismissing Governor DeSantis, that he's imploding, whatever it is. I don't believe Trump will meet the expectations. I don't believe Haley will come in second. And I believe Governor DeSantis will way outperform his expectations, which will give him momentum moving forward. I'm even bullish enough to believe he has a shot to win the Iowa caucuses on Monday night.
Should former President Trump prevail, because he is leading right now, it seems, could you support him? Do you think he is a moral man?
Elections come down to choices. And so the Trump administration versus the Biden administration, I'd be in that camp of the Trump administration was way better for families and for our issues. And God has always used flawed people throughout Scripture, whether it was David or Moses or Abraham. They all had significant flaws, and he used them for his purposes. So that would may be above my pay grade, but if it's a Trump administration versus a Biden administration, I don't see that's going to be a choice for me. I mean, for me, that'll be an easy choice.
You could choose not to vote at all.
Oh, no. I would choose Trump. I would choose the Trump administration over the Biden administration every day that ends in Y and twice on Sunday.
Trump is someone who you yourself have said parents, grandparents generally don't want him to be a role model for their children.
Big hurdle, there's no doubt.
I know you've said that the Bible says God uses flawed people. Every politician is flawed. You know, Donald Trump, as you say, someone who doesn't want to be a role model, I think there's just a disconnect between the evangelical movement that says it's about family values and supporting, and in this case, you said if there's no other choice, you would support him, someone who you don't think should be a role model for your children.
Well, the disconnect there is right. I mean, there's no doubt, I've said that one of the biggest hurdles that Donald Trump has is I have not met a parent or grandparent yet who has said they want to have their son, daughter, grandchild grow up to be like him. That said, I haven't heard anybody say that about Joe Biden either. And Joe Biden's policies are way more detrimental to the family than, say, Donald Trump's record has been for the family. So it comes down to a choice. And in this situation, it's going to be a flawed choice. You have 75% of Americans who are saying they don't want the choice between Biden and Trump. They want somebody different. Even heard somebody say the first party that runs to the next generation leader wins. And so I just think, again, let Iowa do its job, present an alternative to the former president, and now let America choose. But I think what I can do as a faith leader, as well as a parent, by maintaining my testimony to the gospel, is by calling balls and strikes. Donald Trump is not my savior. Can God use Donald Trump to accomplish good things? Yes, he's always used flawed people to accomplish good things for him.
Trump also tapped into something else, which is anger.
Sure.
Right? And I want to ask you what you think of evangelicals expressing anger, which is something in the Bible. Jesus was angry, yeah. Sure. But do you think that evangelicals have changed politics, or are you concerned that politics is changing them?
I think where some of the evangelicals even say resonate to a Trump and his disruptive behavior.
Anger, sometimes hate.
But they kind of believe they need somebody to be a disruptor right now. The reason is they're concerned when a government's telling them that these aren't your children, these are our children. And if you don't believe in gender transitioning, or if you don't believe in the LGBTQ movement, or if you don't believe in whatever else we believe in, you may not be able to raise your children. That scares a lot of evangelicals. Or it's not about religious liberty. You can't live out your faith. You have freedom of worship inside your four walls, but keep it inside your four walls. They're saying religious liberty is about living out my faith. And now I got a government saying, I can't live out my faith. That's why I think some evangelicals are going, listen, they're weaponizing against Trump, but they're also weaponizing against us. So if they're going to weaponize against us, I'm going to stand with him. Okay? But I'm saying we have a choice right now.
Bob Vanderplaats, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Vanderplaats and everyone interested in this campaign is facing a deep freeze now from Mother Nature as temperatures are starting to drop into the single digits. And that has meant a freeze on campaigning as well, with Ron DeSantis postponing four events today, Nikki Haley moving to all virtual events, and Vivek Ramaswamy doing one town hall from inside of a car as he was trying to get through this weather.
Lisa, that winter weather we see you standing out in the middle of right now, that's going to make it tougher for folks to travel, fewer events for them to go to see the candidates. How is all this going to impact, or could it impact, Monday's caucuses?
We always wonder about the weather, but I will tell you that right now, this is bad news for anyone who is not Donald Trump, because everyone else needs to make up ground against him. And they're not out there campaigning. They're not able to meet as many voters as they would have during these two last critical days. I think today and tomorrow it will be harder to get back to a full campaign as you normally see. And it's even more difficult because there are, in fact, persuadable voters still out here. There are a few undecided voters. We met one last night, someone who was a Chris Christie supporter.
What I like about Chris Christie is he was a Republican that governed a Democratic state, so he could reach across the aisle and get things done, and that's what I want. Recently, we moved here from Arizona, and the border is an issue, so I want somebody that can actually work with the other side to get something done that's reasonable.
Now, Ross told me he had not decided yet. He was at that DeSantis event, and we're going to keep track of where he goes Monday night. But meantime, these candidates are looking for every sort of eyeball, every vote they can get. I do think things will change on a Sunday, Monday, once this storm system clears. Believe it or not, what you're seeing behind me, this is actually plowed. Cars are going to start getting back on the roads. The question Monday night will be cold weather. And that will be a test of enthusiasm for Trump voters. Do they think he has too much of a lead? Do they stay home rather than actually show up? That is the hope, frankly, of some of his opponents.
All right, that is Lisa Desjardins just outside of Des Moines for us, days ahead of those Iowa caucuses. Lisa, thank you. And be sure to join us for live coverage of the 2024 Iowa caucuses on Monday night, starting at 11 p.m. Eastern, right here on PBS.
The U.S. and other parts of the world are in the midst of another COVID-19 wave. Infections and hospitalizations are on the rise this winter, and a new variant is responsible for a majority of those cases. John Yang has the latest and a look at whether we need to change our approach to the virus.
Jeff, the World Health Organization said yesterday that in December, nearly 10,000 COVID deaths were reported in Europe and the Americas. In the United States, hospital admissions are on the rise, up 56% last week from the month before, but they're still far lower than they were in previous years. In Europe and the Americas, ICU admissions are up 62% from the month before. The Director General of the WHO said public health officials need to be vigilant.
Although COVID-19 is no longer a global health emergency, the virus is still circulating, changing, and killing. Data from various sources indicate increasing transmission during December, fueled by gatherings over the holiday period and by the JN.1 variant, which is now the most commonly reported variant globally.
So what do these current trends mean? Dr. Eric Topol is the founder and director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute. He's been warning about the risks of this new variant. Dr. Topol, how concerned are you about this current uptick?
Well, good to be with you, John. I think the main thing here is that we're seeing a massive number of infections, second most throughout the entire pandemic after Omicron. And so while the hospitalizations are not as bad, and you mentioned already the death toll, that's reassuring because of some of the immunity we've built up. But this virus has evolved, and it's markedly different than previous versions we've seen, and that's a challenge for the spread and for the infections and the potential of long COVID in many of those people as well.
Talk about that evolution, this new variant, JN1. Is it more dangerous? Is it more infectious? What tell us about it.
Right. So in the course of the pandemic now, at the beginning of our fifth year here, there's only been two times when a variant came along with more than 30 new mutations in the spike protein. You know, usually a variant has a couple, a few, but this is, you know, we call it an Omicron event because that was the first time we saw one. And then, of course, back in the fall, we started to see the rise of the precursor to JN1 with another 30 plus mutations in the spike protein. And so when you have this many new mutations, the virus has essentially found a way to work around, bypass our normal immune response. And so it gets to be very infectious, easily getting people who have already been infected, no less those who have not had COVID before. So it's good that we have 4 years of built up exposures and vaccinations and boosters, but it's bad that this virus is relentless in finding ways to basically reinvent itself and to get into our upper airway and then all the other potential things that can happen after that.
You mentioned long COVID. You've been very vocal about this, about the need to understand long COVID, understand who's at risk for long COVID. Explain your concerns and also whether or not the repeated infections play any role.
Right. Well, there's no question that repeated infections introduce a higher risk of long COVID. And the problem, John, with long COVID is we don't know who's going to get this. Over time, since the beginning of the pandemic, it looks like the incidence, you know, has dropped some. And that's partly because vaccinations are quite protective, 40 or 50% reduction of long COVID, as well as with boosters. But the problem is, you know, even with vaccinations or without, some people can have this terrible long-term problem of their immune system getting totally out of sorts and having, you know, self-directed antibodies and so many markers of inflammation across the body throughout every organ system, no less, you know, a disabling set of symptoms. So even if that is just a couple percent of people in this current wave, this big global surge, that's still a lot of people who we've added to the tens of millions of people currently suffering from long COVID around the world, and we don't have any treatment for it. We know some things that can prevent it, but we have nothing yet that's been substantiated to treat long COVID.
You had an op-ed column in the Los Angeles Times last week. In it, you wrote, "It's crickets from the White House on COVID now, with no messaging on getting the updated booster or masking. The Biden administration has done far too little to accelerate research on effective treatments for long COVID." What would you like to see the administration do?
Well, a lot more than it's doing. You know, in the first year of the pandemic, we saw that Operation Warp Speed, and we took this virus as an existential threat and pulled out all the stops. But right now, John, we need oral or nasal vaccines to stop infections, to stop spread, to be variant-proof, whatever this virus mutates to in the times ahead. And we have a small amount of funding towards that end, but not enough. And the messaging has been poor. That is, you know, even the people at highest risk, about 35% of them have had the updated booster that's been available since September. That's the highest risk people of advanced age. We had 90-95% of those same high-risk people getting the initial primary series of the vaccine. So we're not doing enough. You know, we've known this was coming. We've seen countries in Europe that had wastewater levels of the virus that were unprecedented, even exceeding Omicron. And it isn't like they stay, the virus is going to stay there. We knew it was coming since September, October. And only in recent weeks have health systems started to get masking back as a policy. We're just not doing enough to prepare or manage this big surge.
Dr. Eric Topol of the Scripps Research Translational Institute, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
In Taiwan, voters head to the polls tomorrow for presidential and parliamentary elections. The results will be as closely watched in Beijing and Washington as they will be in Taipei. China considers Taiwan a breakaway republic, and President Xi Jinping often speaks of reunification with the island. Nick Schifrin looks at the candidates and the stakes for tomorrow's vote.
Taiwan's election is cacophonous, colorful, and a little chaotic. It's also critical to the future of the region. The leading candidate is Lai Ching-te, known as William Lai, the current vice president from the Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP. He vows to continue Taiwan's current de facto independence and uses more moderate language about Taiwan's relationship with mainland China than he used to.
I will maintain the status quo and continue to bring society together. Our door will always be open to engagements with Beijing.
But the People's Republic of China, or PRC, appears to be keeping the door shut tight. Recent military exercises have helped deliver Beijing's election warning. There will be more tension, more satellite launches.
It is not the moon.
More balloons flying over Taiwan like the one that flew over the U.S. last year, if you choose William Lai. Wang Wenbin is the foreign ministry spokesman.
Lai Ching-te 顽固坚持台独分裂立场.
Lai Ching-te clings stubbornly to the separatist position for Taiwan independence. He is a troublemaker through and through.
Sometimes people describe him as a pro-independence leader, but that's not really the position he's taking in this election.
Shelley Rigger is the faculty dean and professor of East Asian Studies at Davidson College. She spoke to us from a campaign office in Taipei.
His mandate, if he wins, is to maintain the current status quo across the Taiwan Strait, which is that Taiwan is a self-governing, democratic entity that hasn't fully separated itself from its history as a Chinese place.
The main opposition candidate, Hou Youyi, is from the Kuomintang Party, or KMT, historically less antagonistic toward Beijing than the ruling DPP.
For the DPP, the path to preserving the status quo is to remain close to the U.S. For the KMT candidate, so Hou Youyi, Taiwan needs to engage with Beijing more actively in order to preserve its security and autonomy.
The election also features for the first time a third party candidate, former Taipei Mayor Ko Wen-je, popular among younger voters.
He's not that different on the major policy areas. His position on cross-strait relations is a little bit hard to discern. But I think his appeal is that he's a new face. The PRC doesn't like any of these candidates, but they dislike Lai Ching-te the most.
That's led to what Taiwan calls Beijing's unprecedented election interference, including Lai deepfakes. That's the real Lai on the left, manipulated Lai on the right. And what the U.S. and Taiwan call disinformation about labs with dangerous viruses and bioweapons. Independent researchers have also found a campaign of fake online accounts disparaging Lai and promoting the KMT. Taipei accuses Beijing of cyber attacks, co-opting local officials, and increasing economic pressure.
China has intervened in every major Taiwanese election, but this time it is the most severe. It can be said that they are leaving no stone unturned.
So are you saying that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment to do that.
Looming behind Taipei-Beijing relations is Washington's relationship with Beijing. The U.S. has expanded its military presence in the Pacific, especially in Japan and the Philippines, to bases closer to Taiwan. And the U.S. has worked to improve Taiwan's military. But the administration says its policy has not changed, including that Taiwan should not declare independence.
We maintain the agreement that there is a one-China policy.
The PRC is really always worried about somehow losing Taiwan. And the thing that they worry about the most, honestly, is that the U.S. will encourage Taiwan or somehow give Taiwan a blank check to bust a move and do something that will force the PRC to respond militarily.
On New Year's Day, Chinese Communist Party General Secretary Xi Jinping reiterated his promise that Taiwan and Beijing will one day fly the same flag.
The reunification of China is a historic inevitability.
Of course, all politics are local. Voters have economic concerns and are exhausted of same-party rule.
Okay, and then my Taiwan-style pork chop. Did you get?
But Beijing is on their mind, and young Taiwanese are increasingly proud to identify themselves as from Taiwan, not China, with Taiwanese food.
Just to cook it all the way.
Taiwanese music, including by bands banned in mainland China, and perhaps most of all, Taiwanese democracy.
They are going to show with their votes their determination to sustain a democratic system and to preserve their freedom.
Democracy here is only 35 years old, but tomorrow the people of Taiwan will choose their next leader, something the people of mainland China are not able to do. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
With just days to go until the Iowa caucuses, presidential politics are taking center stage. Let's discuss that and more with Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. It's good to see you both. Let's talk a bit about Iowa, shall we? David, the latest poll of Iowa voters found that among Republicans, former President Donald Trump has a dominant lead. That hasn't changed. But this is the first poll to find that Nikki Haley is now opening a real lead over Ron DeSantis. She has 20% to his 13%, and her lead is outside of the poll's margin of error. How do you interpret these numbers?
Disastrous for Ron DeSantis. I mean, he's really bet a lot on Iowa. He's said to have an amazing ground game. He's invested zillions of dollars in Iowa. And if he's down to 13%, I don't see how the campaign really goes forward. He said he'll go to South Carolina, maybe skip New Hampshire. But I just don't see how he recovers from showing that bad when he's invested this much time and effort. As for Nikki Haley, very good number for her. She's kind of late in the game, less organized on the ground. On the other hand, there is a ceiling on her. And that's because if you look at who's voting for her, it's college-educated Republicans, and this is a working-class party, and she has done very poorly trying to crack into that working-class group. She's done very poorly trying to crack into that evangelical group. And so Trump has great organization, great presence. People are waiting to wait around. I've read recently 5 and 6 hours as he shows up late. They'll stick around. They want to see Donald Trump. So all indications are that Donald Trump is sitting pretty, and if those polls are right, then Ron DeSantis is in trouble.
And Jonathan, you could argue there are two ways to look at this, that one, Nikki Haley is even better positioned to do well in New Hampshire, especially if she has a strong showing in Iowa, or that the race for number two is meaningless when the front runner is 30 plus points ahead. How do you see it?
Exactly. I keep wondering, why are these people in the race? One, because the front runner is 34 points ahead in that poll, in the Suffolk University poll you just showed. But also he's ahead in all of the polls, and they have not taken the gloves off against him, except for I think Nikki Haley took the gloves off this week And Ron DeSantis, in some way, took the gloves off. But they should have been doing that from the moment they got into the campaign. And so, again, as I've said on Friday nights now for at least a month, maybe two, when it comes to the Iowa caucuses, I will be curious to see if that 34-point spread in the Suffolk University poll shows up in actual votes. And if Donald Trump doesn't wipe the floor with Haley or DeSantis, whoever comes in number two, then we have to start to wonder, can he make it through? Can he make it through New Hampshire? And does that provide an opportunity for Nikki Haley to maybe win New Hampshire, but then get obliterated in her home state of South Carolina?
Well, how can Nikki Haley capitalize on Chris Christie's exit from the race? Because the one thing his campaign proved is that there is no nationwide constituency for a Republican who's willing to break with Donald Trump in the way that he did.
Right. Yeah. Now, there's a let me go to my traditional role as the irrational optimist. And there is a scenario for Haley. She does well in Iowa, or better than expected, maybe comes within 25 points of Donald Trump. She goes to New Hampshire. Christie's gone. DeSantis is sort of out of it, even if he's not officially out of it. And then she's really, with Christie out, she's in the realm of tying Trump. She's sort of in the ballpark. That would be big news. He's basically a sitting incumbent president. And if a sitting incumbent president loses New Hampshire, then that's big news. I agree with John. She'll then go on to lose her home state. But then after that, we have Michigan, which is an open primary, and independents can vote in it. And so that looks a little better for her. And then after that, we have a whole run of states. So there's some plausible scenario. The way things are breaking, it turns out to Haley Trump in short order, and then she has some remote chance.
Jonathan, what do you think? Does Chris Christie's exit change the dynamics of this race in any meaningful way?
No. And unfortunately, that's the case. I mean, you know, I don't agree with Governor Christie on a whole lot of things, but I thought his role as a candidate for the Republican nomination was an important one because he was fearless in taking the argument to the party against Donald Trump. And the fact that a person who is telling the truth about a four times indicted on 91 counts former president shouldn't be the standard bearer of their party, the party rejected him by not supporting him, meaning Chris Christie. And so it's unfortunate that he had to get out of the race, but it's also unfortunate that there's no constituency for the truth-telling that he has.
Let's talk about the Biden campaign, because the Washington Post reported this past weekend that former President Barack Obama has raised questions about the structure of President Biden's reelection campaign and has even discussed this with President Biden himself. Of course, David Axelrod, the former Obama strategist, he's been very public about his own criticisms about the campaign. And to be clear, they're not criticizing President Biden. They're criticizing the effectiveness and the messaging of the campaign. In your view, is there reason for worry?
Yeah, I mean, they're now, well, first, there's reason for worry, because if the election were held today, in my view, Donald Trump would be elected president. So that's reason for Democrats to worry. And in my conversation with Democrats around the country, I've noticed there are now 85 million political consultants. Every Democrat I know has got some words of advice on how Biden can do a lot better. And I happen to agree with the Obama people. And by the way, the Biden people will hate it when the Obama people judge them. And I do think Axelrod and Obama are essentially correct, that of course he had to do a January 6th speech. Of course going to Mother Emanuel Church was important. But he does have to show how I'm going to make your life better. And the core reason Donald Trump is doing okay is a lot of Americans think their life was better under him than under Biden. And so there, in my view, he has to look at the Reagan campaign in 1980, an old guy who said, no, here's what I'm going to do for you. And he has to have law and order. Donald Trump is an agent of chaos, a lawbreaker. For a Democrat to be a law and order, a persuasive law and order candidate at a time of global chaos, that would be a good thing. And then I think he really has to somehow get into the working class. You can't give away that many votes, especially among the Hispanic working class. So I think he has to champion business, small business, and show he's for enterprise and aspiration. And these are not the usual Democratic themes, but I think he really needs to do it to sort of claw back some of that working class.
Jonathan, I know you're deeply sourced in both Biden world and Obama world. What do you make of this sense among some Democrats that the campaign isn't as nimble or as effective as it needs to be to meet the moment?
I file this under it's like a file folder within the Democratic bedwetting folder that I keep. But that being said, I do think that Democrats should be running scared. I do think that it is important that former President Obama is talking to the current president and saying, hey, you need to take this seriously. But I am also confident that President Biden and the Biden campaign absolutely are taking the threat of Donald Trump seriously, and taking seriously that their message isn't getting through. I mean, I take David, you know, everything he just said is right and true. But as he was talking about the things that the president should be doing or the campaign should be doing, I was thinking back to last fall when the president was doing and the campaign and the administration was doing exactly that. I think that we have to not look at this campaign as from the snapshot of 1 week and, oh, my God, because they didn't talk about this or they didn't have a message on that this particular week, that they're not going to be talking about it or have been talking about it. So I am not worried, but I do think that Democrats need to give the administration, give the president, give the campaign the room to let its campaign unfold. And rest assured that they take the threat of Donald Trump, but also the Republican Party seriously. Because think about this, if Donald Trump through some miracle is not the Republican nominee, Trumpism is still abroad in the land. MAGA is still abroad in the land. And so whether Trump's the nominee or not, there still will be an alternative for Biden to run against.
You know, that raises the question in the minute and a half we have left. I was going to move to another topic, but I'll stay on this one. What is the future of the Republican Party? I mean, Donald Trump will cede the ground at some point as the sort of titular head of the Republican Party. What is left?
It's going to be a different party. It's going to be a working class party. And, you know, we too often look at America only. Every country has a right-wing populist party. And so it's going to be a party that's going to be suspicious of foreign adventures, unlike the earlier Republican Party. It's going to be a party suspicious of international trade. It's going to be a party that represents the hope for the Republicans is we're going to be a multiracial working class party. And they're not far away. The Hispanic movement to the Republicans has, among the working class voters, has been very significant. Even some of the black working class has moved a little, not that much, but a multiracial working class party is what they are hoping for, and it's not impossible.
David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, good to see you both. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Be sure to tune in to Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight on PBS. Moderator and editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, and his panel will discuss the escalating conflict with Yemen's Houthi rebels, the countdown to the Iowa caucuses, and Donald Trump's week in court.
And tomorrow on PBS News Weekend, two new studies find we're eating and drinking more microplastics than previously thought. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us and have a great weekend.